good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon, USA, and online at www.kboo.fm. My name's Andrew Geller, and we are now in our Spring 2006 membership drive. If you folks keep the phones ringing at 503-232-8818, or toll free at 877-500-5266 during the program, and we hit our sizable goal, then we don't have to break as often. I also want to let people know that there is a $500 anonymous match. So the first 500 bucks in gets matched. You can double your money if you're one of those early callers. Keep that in mind. So, as I said, my name is Andrew, and today we are going to be speaking with Maud Barlow. She is the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, which is Canada's largest citizens advocacy organization. She is co-founder of the Blue Planet Project, which works to stop the commodification of water worldwide. She's a director of the International Forum on Globalization, which many of you know is a research and education group based out of San Francisco opposing economic globalization and providing positive alternatives. She's won numerous awards, including the 2005 Right Livelihood Award, considered the Alternative Nobel. Many honorary degrees, author of many books, including Too Close for Comfort, her latest, released last year. Too Close for Comfort, Canada's Future Within Fortress North America. And I'm very pleased to have you here in the studio. Good morning, Maud.
Good morning.
So, primarily I want to work off what you've got here in Too Close for Comfort. And some of these topics I've actually addressed with colleagues of yours at the Council of Canadians, most specifically last fall with Guy Caron, talking about deep integration.
Yeah.
And in preparing for this show, talking to housemates of mine, we were speculating that a lot of Americans probably know vastly less about Canadian government and politics than Canadians know about the U.S. I was guessing that most Americans couldn't name the prime minister, the party, and how long he's been in office. And I knew I couldn't, so I looked it up. His name is Stephen Harper. He's been in office since February 6th, and he's with the Conservative Party, which he founded about 3 years ago.
Impressive.
Well, the internet's handy. So just at the front end, for context to more topic-specific parts of the book, I want to talk about political and cultural changes that have been going on in Canada in the past, say, decade or two. And from your perspective, I'm just curious what you feel those trends are in how Canadian politics has shifted and how much of a role the United States has played in that shift.
Big, good question. First of all, delighted to be here, Andrew, and this is terrific. And I'm glad to be talking about this because I think Americans need to know that the rest of the world knows a lot about the U.S., particularly Canadians know. But Americans don't have to know as much about the rest of the world because that's what it's like when you're the superpowers. So, yeah, I absolutely agree. And it's good for Americans to know what's happening in Canada because we're so closely allied and they are moving to create this thing we're calling Fortress North America. They're not calling it that. They're calling it NAFTA Plus or a common market or whatever. Most Americans don't know this is happening. So it's really important to talk about this and the future of North America and what it would look like. Would it be a European Union type arrangement where they have, sharing of resources, and where some of the foundation is environmental and social. Now, there's also the other sort of corporate model, and there's a real fight in Europe around that. But what model is it that they're looking for? And really what they're looking for here is the security perimeter around North America based on George Bush's war on terror and, missile defense system that would include Canada. And I'm afraid the new government's going to buy into it, which the old government did not. And basically sharing of resources, but in a bad way in the sense of overusing them and deregulation of environmental services and regulations and so on. So, yeah, it's really important for us to talk. What's happened in Canada is this, that Canada, through free trade and through the predecessor to NAFTA, which was the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, has really become part of the global economy the way the World Bank forces developing countries to become that. Only they call it structural adjustment, and they go in and they say, okay, you owe this huge debt to the North. We loaned you money, and you haven't paid it back, and the interest rates went up. And so in order to get debt relief, we're going to, we want you to buy the market economy. We want you to export your best, use your best land for export for commercial products like strawberries or roses or whatever that the North wants. And and we want you to deregulate and your energy infrastructure and your transportation, and we want you to let our corporations come in and run your education and public health system. And now they're doing it on water. Now that's what happened in the developing world. In the so-called developed world, it was free trade. And I don't know if most Americans know this, but the first free trade agreement in the world was the predecessor to NAFTA. It was signed January 1st, 1989. It was called the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, and it became the model for NAFTA, which became the model for the WTO.
Now, was that negotiated under the Reagan administration?
It was. Okay. Reagan and Brian Mulroney in Canada. He was a conservative, quite right-wing, and they were very close, good allies. And there was a huge fight in Canada about it. I mean, it was the issue through the mid-80s to the election in 1988. And the only reason we ended up getting it, because the majority of Canadians were against it, was that there were three political parties. Two were opposed to the free trade agreement. The one party that was in favor of it got enough votes to form the government because the opposing view split between two parties. So we didn't want it. We got it. And that morphed into NAFTA, which has proven to be as problematic as we said it would be. And what happened with these trade agreements, and it wasn't just them, but they were the centerpiece of it, is that Canada basically adopted neoliberal market policies. We have a legacy quite different from the U.S. of what I call sharing for survival, which is that we were a small number of people based mostly along that Canada-U.S. border in this big, vast, harsh, geographically harsh country, right? Cold. And in order to survive, both just literally physical survival in that kind of climate, and also just as a separate nation state on the northern half of that North American continent, our ancestors had to share for survival. So they brought in what I call ribbons of interdependence, east to west and north. And that was, public services, post offices, transportation, health care, family allowance, pensions, everything was, we trusted our government much more than Americans do. I would call the American narrative survival of the fittest, where I would say Canadian narrative is sharing for survival. And so we have a very different social history, much less poverty, much less wealth. We didn't have the extremes of wealth and poverty that Americans do. We had much more faith in the notion of government. For instance, we have a national broadcasting system, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC, that's government-funded. Although it's arm's length, it's allowed to criticize the government. It's not like people say, it's like a Soviet arm of the government. It is not. It is independent, but it exists so that we have a facility to talk to Canadians and have our perspective, because living next to the biggest superpower in the world, it would have been easy just to be drowned out, right? Your private radio, your private television, and so on. As it is, you can get in Canada, ABC, NBC, Fox News, like the whole, you can watch whatever you want. You go into our magazine stores or our news stores, it's all American magazines. I mean, it's not like American culture isn't in Canada. It's very much there. But we have also tried to preserve space for Canadian culture. All of that's under attack. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, it almost in reading those introductory chapters in Too Close for Comfort, it seems like, it seems like Canada is about 15 or 20 years, I'm going to use the phrase behind the U.S., but it's not like it's something they should aspire to achieve. Yeah. But it just seems like a lot of the same political and cultural shifts that have taken, that are really firmly entrenched here in the U.S. now, are slowly making significant inroads in Canada.
Absolutely. Even to the point of mirroring the establishment of this this corporate lobby. It was called the Business Roundtable and was set up in the mid-1960s or late 60s in Canada, and then in the U.S., and then Canada set up its own version of that called the Business Council on National Issues, which is now the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. But it doesn't matter. What it means is really that, you know, they're all the same. It's mm-hmm. and a lot of them are big American corporations anyway. But setting this it was what somebody in the Trilateral Commission in the 1970s called the excess of democracy in North America and Europe. They had to get away from it, so they had to undo the inroads for human rights and women's rights and social rights generally that had been made. And so basically what happened was that the same processes and the same corporate interests that sort of took precedence in the United States have started to move into my country and countries around the world, as a matter of fact. And you're right, it's slower with us because it's like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, but it's still happening.
That's Maud Barlow. She is the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, and she's here in studio at KBOO launching our spring membership drive. She's speaking tonight at the First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. I'm not going to remark on the availability of tickets because it's said it's sold out, but I've heard there could be opportunity for a few folks to make their way in if you don't already have tickets. And that is, wow, I don't see the time listed here. Yes, I do. It's 7:30. So I would say kind of get there early if you already don't have tickets. So you're listening to People Rise Up. My name's Andrew Geller, and Maud Barlow, National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians, is my guest. She's written Too Close for Comfort, Canada's Future Within Fortress North America. $60 pledge gets you your own copy. This is not something that'd be simple to find here, but you can get yours through your community radio station today. So we talked a little bit about the political and cultural shift that's been going on in Canada that's bringing Canadian politics sort of more in line with how the U.S. operates, unfortunately. And now I want to talk a little bit more topic-specific from Too Close for Comfort, kind of grouping some of the chapters together to look at the issue of deep integration and deregulation. I did a show last fall with a colleague at Council of Canadians about deep integration. For people who missed that, can you give us a quick snapshot of what deep integration means?
Well, it's really the creation of closer ties between Canada and the U.S. and Mexico to some extent, but based on a very business kind of corporate model. What happened in my country is post 9/11, the big business community said, well, you know, that border's going to start to get real rough for our goods to go across, goods and services to go across. We, you know, we're a big supplier of everything to the U.S. Like almost 90% of our exports go to the U.S.
That was something that I learned. I didn't realize that Canada was so incredibly dependent.
Oh, yeah, totally. And that's post NAFTA. That's post the first free trade agreement. What we always said was that we would become totally dependent on the U.S. And if anything happened to close that border, we'd be in trouble. Well, 9/11 happened and the security just went crazy at the border. And everybody started accusing Canada of having this porous border and all these terrorists coming across, which is not true. But in any case, that was that's the official line in Washington. So the big business community in Canada said, okay, well, what we have to do is offer up everything. Let's offer up our energy. Let's offer up our water. Let's offer up our healthcare services, whatever the U.S. wants. And what Bush said, well, we really want two things. We want you to be cooperative with our missile defense system. We want to have their ballistic missile defense plan, which is crazy. But anyway, they wanted to be able to situate those all through Canada and have one North American ballistic system. And then the other thing is that the Bush administration wants is for Canada to be involved in a much closer security arrangement. So that, for instance, if somebody comes from somewhere to visit someone in Canada and has no intention of going to the U.S., they'd still have to satisfy U.S. authorities that they can come into the new bloc. So it's creating a new bloc, kind of like a European Union, but without the social and environmental safeguards. Most Canadians don't know what's happening. Most Americans don't know what's happening. But it started officially with the signing of the Security and Prosperity Initiative last March in Waco, Texas, when the heads of the three countries, Mexico, Canada, and U.S., met and signed this long-range agreement to create this thing. Didn't go to Congress. It did not go to the Canadian Parliament. It was just this agreement they signed and have subsequently started merging all sorts of systems, including the deregulation of environment and food systems and so on, which I'm really concerned about, Now they're meeting again. The new Canadian Prime Minister Harper, George Bush, and Vincente Fox are meeting in Cancun, Mexico. I think it's the 30th of this
probably
month.
The same place they held the WTO.
Exactly the same place. They doubled, yeah, and there will be protests, I can assure you, because a lot of the same folks will remember and will realize it's the same agenda. But they will be advancing this common market, this whatever you want to call it, NAFTA plus that they're building. And people need to know that it's based, and the interests are this, that it would serve American corporate and security and military interests. Mexico would provide labor and some energy, and Canada would supply political acquiescence and resources. So from our trees to our energy to our water to our minerals. That's what this is about. It's about what one premier of a province in Canada called zip-locking North America into a security perimeter. It's the wrong, in my opinion, it's the exact wrong model for North America. It's not based on conservation. It's not based on sustainable community awareness or lifestyle. It's based on more consumerism, higher abusive use of and overuse of our resources. And it's based on this notion of George Bush's war on terror and wanting Canada and Mexico to totally join in. And whoever is his enemy has to become our enemy as well. And I worry about it doubly now because the new prime minister was in favor of the war in Iraq, would have taken Canada in. The last prime minister was not. And the new prime minister is in favor of Canada joining ballistic missile defense. The last prime minister was not. So I think there's more of a meeting of minds that's going to take place between the new conservative leader, Stephen Harper, and George Bush. I think they're cut of the same cloth. They're both fundamentalist Christians. They're both, you know, have a record of being anti-gay and having a very, you know, narrow, limited view of human rights. So I worry that there's going to be a meeting of minds. Now, Vincente Fox is the interesting one because this will be his last meeting. He's finished as president soon, and it may be a left-leaning president that next faces these two in Obrador, the former mayor of Mexico,
yes,
which will give George Bush conniptions in the middle of the night.
Well, and if recent elections south of the U.S. border
yes.
are any indication, then
it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, from Evo Morales in Bolivia to, yes, of course, Chavez and it's so this Latin Americans, it's very interesting that Canada turned right when all of Latin America is turning left. And what I do want your listeners to know is that we don't have a system like here in the U.S. We really literally have enough parties that it was the conservatives who kind of came up, just got enough votes to form what's called a minority government. But two-thirds of Canadians did not vote for this guy and were mortified that somehow he's our prime minister. It's temporary. He will be gone, we hope, in 2 years.
Yeah,
anyway.
Well, that's the way a lot of listeners,
yeah.
I think, feel
I
about
know,
George
Bush and how that election got – I know.
And
the rogues. And I have a – as you know, I have a chapter in my book on the rogues. I called it a rogues gallery.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't start that way. I actually had the story of the Karl Roves and the Frists and the Delays and all these guys in the chapters. But then the stories became so powerful. I mean, who these people are and what they believe, they're so frightening. Well, really, if you look at their history, some of them are just crazy.
There's books based solely in the style of your chapter. Journalist Laura Flanders in the U.S. wrote a book all about Bush women, the women in the administration. I know there's other books that kind of just provide profiles of the folks in charge, but that's not really what we're talking about.
Yeah, but it matters in the sense that their personal beliefs do end up writing foreign policy, and I mean, for some of the. The diehard far-right evangelicals in the Bush administration, they actually think degradation of the environment's a good thing because it hastens Armageddon. I mean, they're really – I know that there's official policy, and you say, well, that's separate from the individuals, but the individual beliefs are really quite frightening, and it is about the deregulation of foods and seeds and – trade and pharmaceuticals and so on. It is about more and more corporate control of all of the sectors of our society.
Well, and it's about the movement of all those goods as well. And one of the fascinating things that I forget what chapter I read it in this book, but it had to do with border issues in a deeply integrated North America. And it talked about, you know, all goods will be able to flow absolutely freely and some people will be allowed to register for basically the ability to fly or, I suppose, board trains and travel without regular security screening because you've gone through sort of a deep investigation and you are, you know, approved. And it talked about how was it that you put it? Something like a state sanction of a class-based social structure.
That's right.
And, you know, basically putting that into policy.
Well, they don't want diplomats and politicians and senior business executives to have to go through the hassle that the rest of us go through at security points. So it's not just Canada, U.S., by the way. Europe and North America are also talking about a special passport. And this would be a passport that eventually they're talking about having a separate line. People with this passport would go through this separate line. It's not because you flew business, although probably you did fly business, mm-hmm. you know. But that's not the criteria. The criteria is that you have been pre-approved and the security. It's like a special class that they're not worried about. And it is all about maintaining those business relationships and that just-in-time business because they don't want that stopped at the border.
Now, you referenced this meeting coming up next week in Cancun, Mexico, to further the North American Security and Prosperity Partnership. When I kept running across that phrase, I didn't remember where I'd seen it originally, and that's actually a project of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives.
Exactly.
Explain how a proposal from C3E, as I'll call it, became what I imagine is a legally binding agreement now between the three countries.
Without going to our parliament or your
legislature.
It's unbelievable. Well, it's a further sign that the only sector in any of our countries now that has regular access to government and that sets the political agenda is the big business lobby. It's the same here in the United States. It's the same in Japan. I mean, you can go, it's the same in Europe. The services industry is dictating the conditions of the negotiations at the World Trade Organization. So it's no different in any of our countries. In our country, it's called the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. They're the 150 biggest corporations, and they are a very powerful lobby. And when they burp, it's on the front page of all our newspapers, which they own, right? I mean, it's like mm-hmm. in your country as well, the media, the mainstream media is being more and more controlled. They sit on the boards of governors of universities. I mean, it's, you know, this is a very powerful sector. And so they wrote these very big background papers and then these formal recommendations calling on the governments to do this. They met together. Tom DeKino, who's the head of this Canadian Council of Chief Executives, is a good friend of George Bush Sr. And he tells a story that he and George Bush Sr. were fishing one day a few months after 9/11. And he said, you know, the border's being closed. It's hurting Canadian business. And George, you got to help me open the border. And he says that George Bush Sr. turned to him and said, what's in it for the U.S.? Unless you can convince the U.S. government that there's something in it for us, why would we? So that's when Tom DeKino openly says now, well, then I started to think, what should we offer up? And we will offer up acquiescence on the war on terror so that if you want armed guards on the Canadian side of the border, we should say yes. We'll join your ballistic missile defense. We'll do whatever whatever you want to be good neighbors. Please, please, please keep that border open. And I say from a standpoint of our sovereign rights, from a standpoint of social, environmental, ethical perspectives, we should just put a halt to this thing right now. It's a very dangerous proposal, and it's a very dangerous process that we've entered into.
That's Maude Barlow. She's the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians and author of Too Close for Comfort, Canada's Future Within Fortress North America. All right, so we're in the home stretch now of People Rise Up. First show of spring 2006 membership drive. Let's keep those phones going, and maybe we won't have to do our last break if we hit our goal of, I think it was $1,500 or $1,600. So Maude Barlow, national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, I don't know why I'm having a hard time saying that, is my guest this morning. We've been talking about U.S.-Canadian relations and working somewhat off her book, Too Close for Comfort, Canada's Future Within Fortress North America, available for your $60 pledge to KBOO Community Radio. And in this last segment, let's talk about natural resources, primarily oil and water, although Canada's got a lot of trees that U.S. timber companies would like to get, but we're not going to have time for that. So oil, Canada has basically the last large reserves of fossil fuels. Well, I shouldn't say fossil fuels because we have more coal than you guys, but oil and methane, natural gas, left in North America. And that's obviously got to be a big part of this whole deep integration push from the U.S. perspective. But Canada's natural gas reserves, I think you wrote in the book, are scheduled to be depleted within about a decade, maybe 15 years. And the oil that you guys have up there isn't really oil. It's tar sands, not oil sands. That's public relations jargon to make you think that it's not quite as thick, viscous, and sandy as it really is. Tell us what's going on up in the Athabascan tar sands in terms of extracting oil.
Well, the first thing you should know is that both because we have this, these resources, and also because the Bush administration wants to wean itself of, quote, foreign oil, Canada now supplies the United States with the most of its energy. We've surpassed Saudi Arabia as the largest supplier, and most Americans don't know this. We have also, you're right, we're running out of conventional gas. We're also running out of conventional oil. So what's left, as you say, is these tar sands. The tar sands are huge. They're in northern Alberta, and there's enough oil, heavy oil, in this bitumen.
It's like quicksand.
It's exactly
thicker.
What it's like. Yeah. Exactly what it's like. There's enough oil in there to pave a 4-lane highway to the moon with off ramps. It's the size of New Brunswick. It's huge. So it could go for years and years. When people talk about the end of oil, that's not quite true. It's the end of easy to get oil in the world, and it's the end of cheap oil. And that's going to have a huge impact on global north, global south. And people are not talking about the class based or society based issues around cheap oil, but there is still oil. Problem is for us in Canada is that it is enormously difficult to get at. It is a mining extraction. It's energy intensive, which means that we're going to be building a pipeline to bring gas from the far northwest, which is up in the Peace River Valley and higher, the Mackenzie Valley, and pipe it across frozen tundra, which is the pristine wilderness. This is going to interrupt the caribou herds and the beluga whales and the wolves and the migration patterns of the birds. It's a terrible thing to do, to bring natural gas to the Athabasca tar sands to fuel this separation of this mining operation. It is devastating environmentally. It also is devastating for the water sources, because it takes, for every unit of energy or oil they extract from the tar sands, they use 3 units of water, one of which gets totally lost to the hydrologic cycle altogether. So we are playing just really serious games with our natural water reserves up there. And we already have done that with conventional oil. We use aquifer water to pump oil out of the ground, which is just insane. But anyway, and all of this through NAFTA is going to the U.S. for the U.S. energy consumption needs. So NAFTA, what we did in Canada, which Mexico, by the way, refused to do in NAFTA, was we signed a proportional sharing agreement with our energy. And so we, of whatever percentage of our production that we are sending south in exports, we can never cut back, even if we're running out, even if environmentally it's causing great concern to us. So we are just watching the voracious mining and rape, frankly, of our remaining oil and gas reserves, all to send to the U.S., because about 70% of our oil now comes here, and almost close to that, about 66% of our natural gas comes here. So we are having to now buy oil from outside the country, which is just insane when we have so much of it. So it's a really contentious issue in Canada. And the problem for us all, if you don't look at it in Canada-U.S. relations, but you look at it in terms of the world is running out of energy of these conventional sources, we should all be conserving. We should all have a totally different relationship. But instead, there's this notion that just keep pumping it, just wherever you can find it, whether it's offshore in delicate fishing grounds that are going to destroy the ecosystem there, it doesn't matter. Just, up in the Alaska Reserve, it doesn't matter. Just keep consuming. And that's for North Americans, it's like you can still have your SUVs and you can still consume all you want. You don't have to think about the fact that we're running out, and we are running out. And I think it gives Americans a sense of security to think there's so much energy in Canada. But it is an environmental cost to what's happening here that people need to know about.
Well, the issue of peak oil production and the loss of clean, you know, relatively clean, because there are different cleanliness grades of oil and other fossil fuels. You know, clean, cheap, easy access to oil has been discussed on this program many times and on other shows. So folks are, I think, a little bit more aware of the issue related to global peak energy oil production and other avenues the U.S. government is taking to secure future fossil fuel supply. But another resource that is not nearly as commodified as oil, water. Now, none of us needs oil to survive, like physically at a biological level, but we all need water.
Yeah.
And more than most of us probably drink each day. It's easy to talk about here, Portland, Oregon. We've got fairly cheap, easy access to all the clean water I could want to drink, but that's not the case in a lot of the world. You wrote a report years ago, which turned into a book, Blue Gold, talking about the commodification of the world's water supply. Today, in fact, is World Water Day, and the World Water Forum, which is an event put on by the World Water Council, just finished up in Mexico. You were down there, and I guess, first off, how would you assess the state of efforts to commodify water?
Well, it's the mighty contest between these two competing visions of water has begun. First of all, it's really important for people to know that the world is running out of fresh, safe, clean, affordable water, which we all were taught back in grade school, which wasn't possible. It's a closed hydrologic cycle. It's a finite amount of available water. It just goes through the cycle and comes back, and Bob's your uncle, right? What they didn't teach us, because they didn't know, is that we were actually able to pollute these for sources of clean water to the extent that they're no longer usable, or people call it dead water, or that we would take water from places that exist, like aquifers, and put it in places that is impossible to get at, like flood irrigation and so on. So basically, the important thing to know about fresh water, and sitting here on a rainy day in Portland, surrounded by rivers and rain coming out of the sky, it's impossible for people to really grasp this baby, but the world is actually facing a global water crisis that's equally serious to the energy crisis, but more serious in, exactly as you say, it's not about money, but rather about people's lives, because people cannot live without water and there's no substitute.
And it's not really widely discussed.
Not at all. It's
here.
Just, no.
I mean, in countries where there is scarcity.
Yes,
and
it's a big issue.
Yeah, it's a big issue, but certainly not here, and especially even in the U.S.
But you know, it should be in the U.S. because the U.S. in many places is running out of water. The National Geological Survey just put out a report a couple of months ago saying that the American Midwest is experiencing the worst crisis in 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientists here will tell you that this is not a cyclical drought. It is a mistake to think that this is a drought that's going to end and something has got something to do with nature and so on.
It's a permanent shift.
It is a permanent shift. We've got too many people living in arid and semi-arid areas. We are pumping up the Ogallala Aquifer way faster than it can be replenished. Americans now are dependent on groundwater for over 50% of all of your water needs, which is way more than we should. And in other countries like India and China, the surface waters are so polluted. 75% of India's surface water, 80% of China's surface water are so polluted that they're unfit for human consumption. So vast places where there are billions of people are now putting these huge industrial bores down into the groundwater underneath the earth, and taking out massive amounts of water. There's a new study from a group of UK scientists saying there is a crisis coming in Asia so soon and so big, because suddenly moving from sustainable farming where people use local water sources or wells, all of a sudden they're just pumping up this water way faster than it can be replenished. And of course, we've got these burgeoning cities that can't meet the water needs of their people, so they're pumping water in from outside their city area as well. So there's a huge fight on. So suddenly, and of course, then aside from the ecological and scarcity crisis, you now have the reality that about 1.3 billion people in the world don't have access now to clean water. And the United Nations says by 2025, that's going to double at least, and maybe worse. So we are facing both a major human rights and an ecological crisis around water. So no surprise, all of a sudden there's a great, I call it a mighty contest around who's going to control the world's declining freshwater stocks. And there are two competing visions. One is the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, World Trade Organization, the big water companies, and a lot of our northern governments. They view water as a commodity, a marketable commodity that should be named as a commodity and a good, put on the open market for sale to the highest bidder and sold. And that's the market will take care of the supply and demand, and we won't abuse it so much, quote, quote, because, well, it'll only be to those who can pay for it. On the other side is a huge movement, a growing international civil society movement. We were in Mexico City for this World Water Forum.
And we just got a minute left. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about what the World Water Forum is.
The World Water Forum, it holds this big forum every 3 years. It's the World Water Council, and they pretend to be a big UN agency, but they're not. They're a big trade show for the world water companies, and they are basically both the bottled water companies and the service corporations, which are mainly European, and they're basically trying to build a global consensus on a privatized future for water so that water will be a commodity. In Mexico City was a massive movement from peoples around the world, particularly Latin America, who are deeply opposed to this, who believe that water is not only a common good and part of our common heritage, but a human right. And who's going to win this contest, I can't tell you, but I can tell you that it's a very, very passionate and powerful debate that's going on, and that will have ramifications for this North American, Fortress North America, because water is going to be one of the areas of contention for sharing or for selling or for taking or whatever between our countries.
If anything that we've talked about in the course of the past hour has sounded interesting to you, you can find out a whole lot more all about it and more in Too Close for Comfort, Maud Barlow's latest book, Canada's Future Within Fortress North America. She is the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, which is Canada's largest citizens advocacy group. She is speaking in town this evening at the First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue at 7:30. If you do not already have tickets, you should get there early. This is sold out, but we've been told that there may be opportunity to sneak some more folks in. Thank you very much for coming onto the program this morning, Maud.
My entire pleasure. And may I just say that there's a terrific organization here in the U.S. called Food and Water Watch. It's foodandwaterwatch.org is their website. And they are the folks to turn to if you want to learn more about the water privatizations in the United States and the fight back and how to get involved.
Do they have a website?
Yes, foodandwaterwatch.org.
Okay. And the Council of Canadians website
is Canadians.org, and you go to the Blue Planet Project.
And the People Rise Up website at KBOO.FM has links to that and soon more resources. Again, thanks very much, Maud.
My pleasure.